And there are three rules of engagement for consumers. And one is specificity, you know, back up the claims. I don't want vague philosophy. Credibility, have the credibility to make whatever statement. And be a neighbor, essentially show up in my community. I want to see how your Better World initiatives are impacting me in my community, my local community. And there's a sort of pebble in the pond definition to community, right? Like, you know, my block, my city, my state, my region, my country. And B Corp is a really easy way. It's not mainstream at all, B Corp, right now. But I think it will be in the future. And what it will be is really an easy way for consumers to kind of go, oh yeah, B Corp, credibility. You know, so it's really a cultural relevance stamp.
You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Delighted to welcome Kirsten DeWest. Welcome to the show, Kirsten.
Thank you for having me.
So let me tell you a bit about Kirsten. She's the founder and CEO of Research and Strategy Consultancy, CI, which stands for Conscientious Innovation. You're the creator of the Shift Report, and you're a leading authority on the global cultural shift towards sustainability and social impact. And you work with major brands like Nike and Adidas and North Face to help them understand and navigate the impact that these changes, these sort of cultural changes, are having on consumer behaviors. So there's all these amazing things that are happening behind the scenes. I guess the brands are busy trying to figure out what is happening to the landscape of their consumers. And you're there helping them sort of navigate. So one phrase that comes up quite a lot is this idea of conscious consumption. Mm-hmm. And so where do you think consumers, what buying decisions are they going to be making in the foreseeable future? Let's say in the next 3 to 5 years. What is it going to be based on?
There's definitely the phrase conscious consumption. And again, there's lots of buzzwords, right? When we're going through a major cultural shift, and I think, you know, I'm guilty of it as well, kind of creating a buzzword to bring to life an idea or a body of insights. So in terms of where they're going, I'll kind of back up on a high level and say what we've been tracking is this culture shift, as you mentioned. And what we're seeing that being defined by is that people, and I'll say people, not just consumers, because, you know, inside and outside an organization, internal employee is really an important area around this, understanding sort of the insides of an organization and what matters to that stakeholder for a brand, increasingly important. But, you know, as people, we are redefining the values by which we make lifestyle choices, engage in brand relationships, and make purchase decisions. And those are integrity, authenticity, community, consciousness, connection, and social responsibility. And, you know, you'll notice the word sustainability per se isn't in there, but that's really the landscape of these new values. And so what we're seeing is consumers navigate those choices through the lens of these new values, which doesn't mean they always make choices in line with those values, but they're really looking to make choices. And so what we can see pretty clearly is that brands that are helping them do that are going to be the ones that are the winners in the future. Those brands that are helping really activate the desire to, you know, be a conscious consumer or make conscious consumption, to use your phrase. And so we saw a few years ago, we started tracking quantitatively around this in 2007. So we've got some interesting trended data.
Yeah.
The insight is really that people cherry pick areas of their life, right?
But what you're saying though is that, I mean, let's take Sears as an example. Okay, so you've got this mm-hmm. traditional bricks and mortar style business. And there are many others like
yeah.
it, you know, feeling pressure from the web, just from a distribution perspective. But also, they must be yeah. tearing their hair out thinking consumers are making different decisions now. So what you're saying is that consumers don't just buy on price anymore. They don't just buy, they're looking for other things. And so the brands that you work with, you're saying to them, look, you know, in 3, 4, 5, 10 years time, if you continue on your current route, then you're going to be way out of whack in terms of what consumers want.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we like to approach it in a more like, if you don't do this, we don't kind of go, if you don't do this, you're going to be fucked. More like, here's the opportunity for innovation. Here's the opportunity for thought leadership. Here's what you need to do to be culturally relevant as a brand and as a business. Because people's values are shifting, and you need to be in line with those. Those brands that we connect with and bring into our lives, either as the places we want to work or the products we want to buy or the services we want to engage with, we want them to be in line with our values.
And you know this because of the quantitative and the qualitative research that you've done. So when you mentioned this report, I mean, you've been in this business for 15 years. So presumably in the early stages, you were banging your head up against a wall, you know, saying, telling people, look, this is happening. And everyone's saying, Oh, yeah.
You can't even imagine. I mean, actually, that's why we ended up going into the research business, which is a classic entrepreneur story of just pivoting. Because when I started the business, I came from the advertising agency world and technology in brand development. So I shifted from advertising, where I worked as a strategist, to working in tech as a brand director. And so when I started the business, you know, insight was really important. You know, insight is a tool for strategy. And CI was originally started as sort of an agency for the good guys.
Yeah.
Right. And quite frankly, there wasn't the business in that sector. I can't even tell you how many people I saw kind of try to leave advertising and sort of start little businesses or connect with me. And we talked about working together and that, you know, just people, rightly so, I understand, kind of gave up and said, there's no money in this. And I was stubborn and hung on.
So this is a real story of not just the work that you do now as well, but it's also of you having this vision back in 2002, 2003, where you're prepared to stand up in front of the United Nations effectively and say, look, you know, this is the way that things are going to be, you know, to be met presumably by stony silence and the sort of tumbleweeds going.
Pretty much. I mean, you know, and that's really why we started saying there's no insight here. Yes. That's about, like, if we look at all the right indicators, I could see it was pretty clear the shift was happening. You know, this was sort of, you know, the Enrons of the world, this sort of thing was starting to bubble up. And the name of the company came from a research study that I did with sort of influencers across the US and overseas. And the insight was there's a very powerful body of people coming that are really conscientious and highly innovative, hence the name.
Yes.
I would never name my company after an insight with a word that long if I was going to relaunch it again.
The CI works, yeah.
Exactly. And so that was really clear. But we could be presenting, I could be going in and talking to clients, and it would typically be connecting with someone who was very passionate about it in an organization, but had no authority, no budget. It really wasn't integrated like it is now.
And it's also, this is way before Facebook, way before social media.
Yeah. So
this is before people had any real comprehension of any type of, I mean, the world has changed significantly in the 15 years.
It hasn't. I mean, it has on the outside. But we first went into the field to do this research because there was just a lack of it for us to do our work as, you know, quote unquote, a communications agency, which is what the birth of the company was. It's now very different. And so I said, there really isn't any research out there. We're going to create it. It's going to be what makes CI unique. We're going to be the authority on this, but we need it because there's nothing out there. I mean, there really were not a lot of organizations. There was one agency I can think of, the Green Team in New York City.
Yeah.
And, you know, a couple of consultants, but there really wasn't a body of strategic insight. And so we went out and, you know, I created this thing called the Shift Report that I saw as very important to have a multi tiered methodology, qualitative, trends and culture, and quantitative. And, you know, even then, Matthew, we would walk in, we had this great body of research, focus groups and in-depth interviews with mainstream consumers and thought leaders and influencers. It was hugely robust. And the quantitative was secondary at that point. Yeah. That happened in 2005. And in 2007, I was like, we need to do primary quantitative, because if we can walk into a room and say, we spoke to 5,000 Americans or Canadians or what have you, and 87% said X, or 69% of people say they want to know about the socially responsible behavior of brands whose products and services they buy, that just put us in a much better position to help our customers. If we could present that, because we were giving them both surprising data and validating data.
And also the challenges must have been to really, I mean, what sort of support, was it the major brands that were leading the way with you at that point? Or if you can see this, presumably you saw the faint signals from the future, you know, 15 years ago. So are there particular groups around the world that really are at the absolute forefront of understanding future consumer trends? I mean, obviously, aside from yourself.
That's very nice of you. I think that, I mean, there's a lot of great organizations studying future consumer trends that are doing, you know, all the holding companies, you know, have kind of trend tracking. You know, when I think would say that, I mean, like the Omnicoms, the WPPs, the IPGs of the world. There's a lot of amazingly talented people looking at sort of the future and futurists. And that's a whole, I mean, you could look at someone in the fashion industry like Lee Edelcourt, who is, you know, very known in fashion, but, and as a forecaster and trend forecaster, to, you know, the Futures Company, which is part of WPP. So there's a lot of different organizations, but I think in terms of looking to a body of people or companies or an organization that may not necessarily have been experts in understanding the consumer space, but really were thought leaders and innovators in terms of putting a stake in the ground into responsible business, values-driven brands and businesses. And so I worked with, at the beginning, we did work with really a range. I came from global brands, but we worked with a range of sort of the NGOs, the local, you know, like an Odwalla. We didn't work with Odwalla, but we worked with like an Odwalla kind of juice brand, you know, very values driven. It's now been acquired and, you know, what have you. You know, so there was organizations that I tapped into and learned a lot from and was inspired by. And at the same time, they were validation of what was happening in the marketplace that these organizations were growing, like Social Venture Network. Social Venture Institute is a gathering of sort of mission-driven businesses that happens in the Pacific Northwest, where you have people like Gary Hirschfield from Stonyfield Farm. You have a guy named Joel Solomon, who's sort of a real influencer and almost like the father of these sort of values-driven businesses by creating this organization called Social Venture Institute. You know, so those kinds of organizations, I felt, I was, you know, when you're starting a new business and it was very values driven, but also marketplace opportunity driven, it was really important to connect with those that shared your passion for business as a lever for positive change. And they tended to be these smaller organizations at the outset. You know, now they're in bigger organizations, these people. So we connect with them there too.
But you've got these tensions because there's a lot of research that's being done. And I think one of the findings that came out of one of your pieces, one of your summaries, is that there's about 109 million Americans who are conscientious consumers, as it were. But that leaves about...
Let's say they want to be.
Yeah, so they're conveniently conscientious. So they're conscientious when it kind of suits them, but which leads me to the other tension where you've got companies like Walmart and Amazon in particular that are pushing new products where they're competing purely on price. So you've got a consumer on one side that wants to make decisions based on authenticity, honesty, trust, and belief in the brand. But the other side, they're saying, oh, it's cheaper if I buy it from this brand. How do you overcome that tension between those two sort of opposing forces?
Well, I think you acknowledge that the tension is there first and look at it as sort of what's the opportunity in that tension. So people are never going to sacrifice kind of price, product, or performance for sustainability or better world. So when that becomes clear to, you know, the market leaders, they say, well, we need to, you know, how can we incorporate that? Because maybe our market share is being taken away from some of these smaller players that do incorporate those values. So we're going to always be a price driven, I shouldn't say always be a price driven, but price is going to be a big part of our brand, like a Walmart, you know, better prices. But, you know, looking at a Walmart as example, they use the power of their supply chain to drive change. Okay. So they're forcing supply chain to respond, being almost a benevolent dictator.
Yeah.
Right. So I think the tension can be a really positive thing. And also acknowledge that, you know, this idea of, I call it almost the activation economy. You know, we're in the activation economy where brands that activate people's values, those new values I mentioned, are going to be the ones that are the winners. And people that do have these barriers to entry, price is a big one, right? Yeah, of course, I care about community and I care about how the workers are treated and I care about, you know, sort of a higher level of happiness versus materialism. And I care about buying local and supporting local business and, you know, blah, 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 and disease eradication and diversity. And I care about all these things. But it doesn't mean I'm making every choice based on that. So we do see things like people taking lifestyle choices into their own hand if they can't afford shopping at, say, a Whole Foods. You know, in Detroit, for example, you have inner city communities taking over old lots and turning them into community gardens. So they too can have sort of local produce and a local community connection. So really innovating themselves as consumers and as people. So the tension, I think, is a really healthy thing because it drives innovation on both ends.
But it's also very difficult. So you've got the big brands that are devoting significant marketing and research spends that we're trying to understand the future consumer trends 5-10 years out. But if we sort of wind it back a bit to a smaller business, I'm not talking about a, you know, one man band or a mum and pop shop, as it were, but you know, the smaller businesses that really see this change, you know, what advice do you give to these companies? Because the question is, how do we become an authentic brand without, you know, there was a term from years ago, which was greenwashing,
you
know, where people, it becomes obvious to people that clearly, you know, this brand is positioning itself as a vulnerable brand when in fact we don't believe a word of it. So how do you overcome that desire to sort of be up with the latest trends, but not trip over yourself in the process?
For a smaller organization, like a more regional or local business?
Just businesses. I'm just saying like a mid-tier business.
Right.
Is trying to transition from what it sees as the normal historical practices of its consumers, is trying to position itself so that it doesn't go out of business in 5 years' time, is trying to understand what these trends are.
Right. It's an interesting question. In fact, we're in the middle of developing a few insight products, sort of SaaS-based insight products. And one of them is going to really be for these smaller businesses who don't have huge research budgets and resources. So we've been looking at that question a lot. I mean, I think what we say to them is it kind of doesn't change. To be culturally relevant, you have to, you know, understand what matters to your current and future audience. And, you know, a big part of that right now is, yes, the authenticity piece, but also the alignment. This is what I would say. I mean, it doesn't matter if it was, you know, a mid-tier business or if it was a Fortune 100. I mean, we work with Nestle, we've worked with some of the mid-tier businesses. So we do kind of play in both ponds, which I actually really enjoy personally. And I think for our business, it's really important. And for our customers, it's really important because we can almost be a portal of conversation between the NGOs, the big Fortune 100, 500, and the sort of the smaller mid-tier. So that piece of alignment, you know, what's true to your brand and what matters to your audience. So that's the most important piece to figure out so that you can be authentic. So to your point, greenwashing, you know, there was also, you know, I'd even call it local washing. Like a few years ago, everyone was like, local, local, you know?
Yeah.
So not have a knee-jerk response, because then you're in a position of reaction. You're not in a position of leadership and innovation. And you're definitely not coming from a place of understanding what's true to your own organization and brand and what matters to your audience and how those two things kind of come together. So the advice is really the same. It doesn't matter the size of the organization. The resources that a particular organization has to dive into that understanding are, of course, going to change.
And if we go back a number of years, so a point when a company is about to launch a product, they would do all sorts of market research. How critical is it now to take on board the values that we talked about, you know, the, you know, integrity, sustainability, authenticity? And forgive my question, is it a must have, or is it something that is all still woolly and undefinable? Are we at the point now, 15 years after you set up your business and saw these faint signals from the future, is it at the point now where it's critical that businesses understand that this is the future, these are the future buying patterns of consumers?
Critical. Absolutely. I mean, it's about, it's just about cultural relevance, right? To be a relevant brand, you have to connect with the culture in which your business is operating. And that's where the culture is right now. And so that's what people are looking for from brands, either, you know, brands they work for, brands they buy. So it's critical.
So if I'm a business saying, look, you know, I've been running my company for the last 20 years, it's worked so far, you know, this is all just, you know, new age stuff. Doesn't mean anything to us. Am I going to be there? Am I going to be in a job in 5 years' time, do you think?
I think you will have a hard time recruiting great talent, retaining great talent, and connecting with a highly influential consumer base.
And I think that's an important thing as well, because it's not just about the outbound stuff in terms of how you market your product to buying consumers. It's how you build your business. And, you know, recruiting people is critical as well, because, I mean, how much of that do you see? And let's explore some of these other factors, because human resources, you know, if I'm a highly skilled millennial and I'm in demand, I'm going to be choosing one company over another. And are these values critical in those decision-making processes?
Yeah, it's absolutely critical. There's a lot of research out there. It's not our research. We haven't tracked this, but there is research around there that says, you know, millennials will take less money to work for a company that is in line with their values, you know, these new values that I articulated earlier. So people want to work, millennials in particular, want to work with an organization that's in line with their values. And they'll be evangelists for it, which is a very powerful place to play as an organization when your internal culture believes in what you stand for and is, and that's driving them to be part of your culture as well. So, yeah.
And this 100%. is across all businesses and not just consumer brands. If we think about, you know, dry businesses like investment firms, you know, is it relevant for an investment company to have these types of values? I can see the relationship. I can see the fair trade example.
Yeah.
But if you like take Goldman Sachs or you know, JP Morgan, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all of those organizations, JP Morgan, they are looking at this very seriously. Impact investing as a sector is growing significantly and getting a lot of traction. So impact investing where, you know, investment products have screening on sort of ESG, they call it, environmental, social governance, basically better world stuff.
And do you think there's going to be a tipping point? So you've been, the research that you've been carrying out for the last, you know, 10, 15 years, the number we've mentioned earlier that you've got, I think you call them the vocal globalist.
Yes.
Yes, right. So you've identified about a third of the US population.
Yeah.
You think there's going to be a tipping point where the momentum just increases at an exponential rate, which suddenly cuts out overnight some of these companies that don't have those types of values?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're going to see happening, and it's starting to happen now, is just that having those values, and again, that it's important for brands and organizations, B2B or B2C, doesn't matter, to think about the importance of that kind of alignment, right? What's true to our organization and what matters to our stakeholders? And what's that sweet spot that brings those two things together? But, you know, absolutely, there'll be a time when it's just cost of entry. We've talked to clients that have shared very transparently with us and said, you know, our initiatives around sustainability, social impact have really been helping us attract great talent. And so it's here, it's happening. And so if brands aren't seriously looking at today, then yeah, I think they will be challenged. And they can look at it in one of two ways. They can look at it as a tool for innovation, which is typically how we engage with organizations, or they can look at it as a tool for risk mitigation.
Absolutely. And there must be all sorts of agencies springing up now who are realizing that their traditional advertising and marketing models are time expired. What advice would you give to a company when they're trying to choose the agency? And how relevant is it? Is the advice, how important is it that it's research-based as opposed to, non-research-based?
Right. That's a great question. I haven't worked in the agency business in a long time, but we do, you know, kind of our work within the client would often brief the agency on it to sort of bring it to life in a storytelling opportunity. I think when clients are looking for any business partner, but particularly an agency, a storytelling partner, without getting into the details on other aspects of that relationship that are important for them relative to this culture shift, it's important that, you know, their agency, I think, understand the culture in which their business is operating, and also push them to look at things a little harder and not as sort of a silo or a sector. So, you know, not coming in, if you have your agency coming in saying, hey, local is really hot right now, or mindfulness is really big right now.
Yeah.
We need to get on that. That shows a lack of understanding of the big picture of where this shift is happening, and where it's going and what it is. And that is what leads to these sort of knee-jerk response reactions. So I think having that big picture understanding is critical. And, you know, if they don't, bringing in partners like us that do have that understanding. And we have worked with agencies in the past that have brought us out as partners and have, you know, that stems from their desire to really serve their customer and give them the best opportunity. So really having that big picture understanding, I think, is key. And looking, you know, is it research-based? Well, maybe, but it's more insight-based, right? Because there's so much information out there. There's so much research. There's so much data. But really kind of distilling what it really tells us is key.
Exactly. And I think we're seeing a real growth in this. I mean, I'm not sure if you've seen the movie that was came out recently, which is about Jean-Paul DeJoria, the story of the guy who came up with the Paul Mitchell hair care range of products.
Yeah.
Patron Tequila. It's a fantastic story of this guy who came from homeless nurse. What he's doing is the movie, the real underlying story about the message of the movie is about conscious capitalism.
Yep.
So in other words, you can still be an entrepreneur. You can make heaps of money. Jean-Paul DeJoria, I think he's giving away half of his profits.
Yeah.
Which still leaves him with several billion dollars a year, you know, so he's not
bad,
you know, but it's that, and there's the rise of the B corporations as well. So these are the things. So at the top layer, you're predicting the future 15 years ago, but now we're seeing these things happening in a tangible way.
It's very exciting. It's a great opportunity.
And the whole B Corp structure, is that, do you think there's going to be a particular spin-off? Is there going to be a polarization of the haves and the have-nots, or the do's and the don'ts? Do you know what I mean? The good companies, the bad companies? Is there going to be a...
irrelevant and irrelevant?
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Probably how I would think about it. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we've just been we have done some research around B Corp in a recent project. But more importantly, B Corp is, I think, a really interesting organization. And it is a very easy way for a brand to fulfill kind of the rules of kind of marketing for good.
Yeah.
So I threw out that stat earlier that we were talking, 70% of Americans say they want to know about the socially responsible behavior of brands whose products and services they buy. So we also want to unpack that a little and say, well, what are those characteristics, right, that you're looking for when you engage with a brand? And if you're going to buy into a brand's claims, what do you want to see it do? Like, what? How does it have to talk to you, and how does it have to tell its story? And there are three rules of engagement for consumers, and one is specificity. You know, back up the claims. I don't want vague philosophy. Credibility. Have the credibility to make whatever statement, and be a neighbor. Essentially, show up in my community. I want to see how your Better World initiatives are impacting me in my community, my local community. And there's a sort of pebble in the pond definition to community, right? Like, you know, my block, my city, my state, my region, my country. And B Corp is a really easy way. It's not mainstream at all, B Corp, right now, but I think it will be in the future. And what it will be is really an easy way for consumers to kind of go, oh yeah, B Corp, credibility. You know, so it's a really, will be a cultural relevance stamp. And it's almost like if you go into like a Whole Foods or an REI, you know, you walk in, or an MEC, Mountain Equipment Co-op, yes, which is like an REI up here in Canada. And those organizations have sort of screens and filters in place to like what things are allowed on their shelves and what things are not allowed on their shelves, which makes it much easier for me as the consumer to go in. I don't have to go and do a bunch of research. I don't have to take my app and scan, like, what are they doing?
Yes.
If I think about the barriers to entry for me as a consumer, they're time, knowledge, price, and pressure. So those are the things that stop me from activating my values.
Yeah.
And a B Corp really removes the time and the knowledge barrier.
Yep.
And makes it a very easy decision. Someone referred to it recently in some research we did as really, you know, a better business bureau kind of.
Yes. Sort of, so it's almost like they've done the work for you.
They've done the work for you. It's exactly, yes, right. Right. I mean, look, I'm really into this stuff. And I have been for a long time. I started the Environment Club in high school, and I was kicked out of it because I read Vogue. Right. So at those times, those two things were not allowed to go together. But I don't go in and do like a full analysis on every product before I'm buying. I go into certain places and, you know, like, you know, most consumers, I cherry pick areas of my life, and different people, depending on the segment they fall in, are going to cherry pick more or less. But a B Corp reduces those barriers to entry.
So I guess for the smaller businesses, for the companies that are not facing overwhelm, but are, you know, realize that they need to do something, that's potentially the B Corp route is something that that you would invite them to look at, or?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the other thing about a B Corp, and we're actually about to go through the process of becoming a B Corp.
Okay.
So I'm going to take the company through the process of becoming a B Corp. And so that's going to be interesting to do. Danone is actually going through the process of becoming a B Corp. So there's small, medium, and large sort of levels of entry for B Corp. And what's interesting about a B Corp too, the community of B Corp, if you are an entrepreneur or you are a smaller or a regional or a mid-tier business, there's a lot of resources in that community, business community, for you to tap into. And it tends to be, I'm less connected with the B Corp community, but I've definitely, you know, connected with people who are B Corps and sort of doing really interesting things around the sector of social impact and kind of better world stuff. And that community tends to be of business owners, tends to be, and business executives, I should say, because some of these companies are public. You know, it tends to be a very supportive community, sharing of information and knowledge, a lot of collective wisdom
yep.
to tap into. So it's a great resource for an organization. Absolutely.
So it's almost, it could be the organic stamp for businesses, as it were, you know?
Yes.
So, when you buy produce, you're looking for organic or fair trade. It's almost B Corp could be one of the early stage differentiators. So, are you a B Corp could be one of the key questions that consumers ask.
When they become more familiar with it, I don't think it's mainstream enough yet for them to even know. But as they hopefully B Corp is going to be investing in building their brand and their story so that it becomes exactly that.
And I think that's the interesting thing, the fact that you've got these stamps saying, which allow consumers to ask that binary question. But talking of binary questions, it's now time for the questionnaire.
Okay.
So this is something that I've borrowed from James Lipton. From Inside the Actors Studio. I made a couple of changes, but so we have 10 questions here.
Okay.
And the first is, what is your favorite word?
Why? It's a question. My favorite word is a question.
What is your least favorite word?
I would put no, but really that means, it's almost a least favorite attitude versus a word, right? When people are like looking at everything as impossible, that would be my least favorite thing. I like to look at what's possible with a very practical, pragmatic path to get there.
And what are you most excited about right now?
On a business level, I'm very excited about our present state and the SaaS-based insight products that we're developing and launching to allow different levels of organization access to our database and our insights and our analytics, which really is in line with the mission of CI, which is to use the power of insight to drive better business and a better world. So if we can make that accessible to a range of different organizations and also on a business level for us, that would be a really positive thing.
And what turns you off right now?
My kids fighting, I think.
I'm not alone there. So,
yeah. Mom, are you on another conference call? Be quiet.
And what sound or noise do you love?
The sound of my kids getting along.
And what sound or noise do you hate?
Them fighting. Yeah. And what was the question you asked me before the sound you love again?
It's what turns you off right now?
What turns me off right now? Okay. Pessimism.
Oh, right.
Lack of consciousness, a general sense of unawareness.
So it's linked to the favorite word being no. So it's that whole negativity.
Yeah.
And what is your favorite curse word?
Well, fuck is a really great curse word. It's got so many, iterations, but I have to tell my kids that they can't use it. So hopefully they won't hear this.
Well, we'll bleed that exactly. They can only listen to the first 33.7 minutes.
Fucker, fuck, shit. Yeah, it's just, there's always good use for a good curse word.
And it's an adjective, it's a noun, it's a verb.
It's exactly.
The universal language in four letters.
Multifaceted.
And what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Cultural anthropology. So really still in the research business on some level, but focusing on kind of deeper and on behavior of people and creatures and in their natural environment.
Fantastic. And what profession would you not like to attempt?
An accountant or an actuary. I would run.
Well, just reading phone books for pleasure. That's right.
Yeah, that would not be a good fit for me. I've become now pretty adept with an Excel spreadsheet after running a business for 13 years, but it is not my favorite place to play.
And finally, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Your journey continues.
Fantastic. Kirsten, I can't thank you enough. You have been fantastic. And I want you to tell people, how do they get in touch with you? How do people find out more about you? How do they tap into these SaaS resources that you're talking about? How do they contact you?
They can go to our website, which is www.ci, C for Charlie, I for Indigo, -shift. shift.com. And they can also email me. I'm on email all the time. So my first name at ci-shift.com. Sometimes it takes me a bit to get back, but I always like to respond and always love to hear from people who are interested in the insights and, you know, in the industry and, as well. So and thank you for having me, Matthew. What a great show you've got going here.
That's very kind. It's been brilliant. And, you know, look forward to following your progress. And I'll put all of these links and all of your contact details on the show notes to make sure that people can get in touch with you. But, you know, Kirsten, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Oh,